From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. We will have a first-time World Cup winner in 2010. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of Spain versus the Netherlands. Also, a television insider who just happens to be an NBA observer critiques the LeBron show and discusses what off-season changes mean for the NBA. Tim Kirkjian on all things Major League Baseball, including Tuesday's All-Star Game and a conversational spin with the much-celebrated Bike Snob. Also, a look at the thriving football combine industry for middle schoolers.
The recruiting process starts at such a young age that the guys that wait until their junior year, it's almost too late. It's gotten to the point where the kids are starting to understand it, that they need to get out and build a resume and build a profile at a younger age.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For a lot of people, tomorrow afternoon's match in South Africa will not be only a game. It will be the epic confrontation that determines whether Holland or Spain will reign as champion of the soccer world. As is customary during the World Cup, the question about the impact of the world's largest sporting event on the game in the U.S. has surfaced. According to Jerry Longman of the New York Times, who's been covering the tournament in South Africa, it's the wrong question, and it's stale into the bargain.
Things have been changing for a long time. I mean, the 2006 World Cup final between Italy and France and the combined English and Spanish TV audience in the United States outdrew the average World Series audience in 2006, from like 16.58 million, I think, to 15.58 million. So I think this will help it along, but I don't think you needed the World Cup to give it a great boost. I think it's inevitable. I think it'll continue to grow.
It's hard to imagine that the enthusiasm for soccer could grow much more in the countries where the sport is already king, countries like, say, Holland.
Well, I will be so orange you won't believe it. I have an orange shirt. I have this silly hat. That's my lucky hat. I have to wear that when Holland plays. And so far, it has been working very well.
That's Johan Hanskamp. Though he currently lives in Montreal, friends back home in Holland have kept him abreast of what's been happening in the streets of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, and Utrecht as the orange-clad Netherlanders have made their way to the championship game, and what's likely to happen if they win.
Well, I think that this country will stop functioning for at least 24 hours. The roads will be jammed just to go to the airport to see the team arriving. This is going to be a national event, and I cannot even imagine what's going on there. But there will be dancing in the streets for sure.
The Dutch have sent a team to the championship game twice before, in 1974 and 1978, but they have never won the cup. Though they are the current European champions, Spain, Holland's opponent, have never won the World Cup either, which helps to explain why the Dutch team is not the only soccer aggregation to have focused the attention of an entire country on tomorrow's game. When I spoke this week with Laura Del Rio, a Madrid native now playing with the Boston Breakers in the Women's Professional Soccer League, she told me the final might be the most important thing to happen for Spanish fans in 10 years, and talked about the big screen TVs drawing crowds to the plazas in Barcelona, Valencia, Seville, and her own native Madrid. Outside the locker room after a Breakers practice, she said she'd already made plans to call her mother, her brother, and her friends back home if Spain wins, though she will not be able to devote all of her attention to Sunday's game, at least once the first half is over.
I think the first half I was with my friend from Spain. And the second half I think in the locker room because we have game after. So I think the second half in the locker room.
Will your teammates in there be rooting with you? I mean, the U.S. went out early. Will they be rooting with you?
My teammates, we are with Spain, too.
So if Spain wins, Laura Del Rio and her teammates will rush out onto the field for their game against the Atlanta Beat with smiles on their faces. And Johan Hanskamp says that if Holland wins, he will be smiling for the next 3 months or so. Though Mr. Hanskamp, who's known to his friends and associates as the Dutch prophet, because he predicted a Holland-Spain final before the tournament began, seems to have prepared himself for the vicissitudes of soccer.
Even if Holland would lose, It's something I don't really count on. But as long as it is a great game, I will be a happy man. It's no shame to finish number two in the world. If you can be number one, that would be just great, of course. But I would be quite content if he would be number two, and it would be a great game.
This from a man who acknowledges that he'll be wearing an orange cat-in-the-hat-type chapeau while he watches the match. Kind of makes you wonder if the Dutch prophet has foreseen that Spain will hoist the cup.
I don't like you, Bill.
Ah, well, maybe not.
The answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
In this fall, man, this is very tough. In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Miami Heat.
The LeBron Show, a.k.a. The Decision, has come and it has gone. The King of Sports has made his Miami proclamation, so now NBA teams not nicknamed the Heat are busy retooling and pondering which of the lesser dominoes will fall to them. Here to weigh in on James' decision and its effect on the 2010 NBA free agent season and, by extension, the world economy is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's good to be here on this sad, sad day.
You're obviously not a Miami resident.
No, yeah, 300 million people not happy. Only the people of South Florida happy about this decision.
Well, in your column on Wednesday, you referred to what you called LeBron's unchecked vanity when describing the events leading up to Thursday's live TV extravaganza. Did you watch Thursday's LeBron show? And if so, did it lead you to change your mind about him at all?
I did watch, and it only confirmed my opinion. I can't believe he has chosen to go to a team that is led by a guy who has already won a championship with Antoine Walker. What is it going to mean if LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade win a championship together? It'll be a big who cares. It'll be kind of like CC Sabathia, Mark Teixeira, and Alex Rodriguez winning a championship together. Yeah, you should win a championship. Big deal.
So you think he should have gone to a team that was, say, mediocre and lifted them up to a championship? Oh, wait a minute. He already played for the Cavaliers.
Well, I do think he should have stayed in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes there is a moral component to these decisions, and those poor people of that woebegone city deserved to have one thing to root for every year. And now they'll get to see Yankee fan and new Miami Heat LeBron James starting the NBA season. Oh, these poor people of Cleveland.
Well, James did seem to be at least somewhat emotional when he talked about leaving Cleveland. I guess you don't regard that feeling as genuine.
Wow, I didn't pick that up. Maybe my high-def television isn't high-def enough to discern the emotion. And by the way, I don't buy the fact that he tossed and turned with this decision up until the 11th hour. I think this decision was made long ago when he was talking on the phone to his buddy Dwayne Wade. And, you know, he stuck a shiv in the back of the people of Cleveland, and good for Dan Gilbert for saying so.
Well, Dan Gilbert also said, this is the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, that the Cavaliers would win a championship before LeBron James does. What do you think?
I've been saying for years they need to run that offense through Anderson Varejao. Of course they're not going to win a championship before the Miami Heat. I mean, Dan Gilbert, in his anger, his rage, and his heartbreak, obviously is a little delusional. I guess it hasn't set in yet for him that the Cavaliers are going to lose 65 games next year, and four of those losses will be to the Miami Heat.
Well, given what you have been saying, I hesitate to ask you this next question, but I'm going to do it anyway. You've written extensively for the movies and for television. If you had been in charge of the proceedings on Thursday night, how would that primetime special have differed?
Well, unless my job as a PR firm was to ruin LeBron James's image, it wouldn't have happened at all. I mean, there was a classy high road way to do this. Can you imagine Larry Bird folding his hands behind his head, leaning back, and saying to every big market team with cap space, please, come dazzle me. Give me a lap dance. You know, it's like it was so gross, this tawdry courtship of LeBron James. I just felt like it was the ultimate low road. And then to break the hearts of Cleveland fans on national television, the team didn't even know when the show started that they were about to get the bad news. I feel like his handlers, and LeBron obviously has to share responsibility for this, this decision, orchestrated this whole circus as if they were trying to damage LeBron James's reputation. And by the way, mission accomplished. I mean, I've been listening to talk radio. I've been reading other people's columns, not just my own. And LeBron is getting annihilated for this whole spectacle.
The Heat, of course, are not the only team preparing for the next NBA season. Tell me about teams out there that might derail LeBron at all.
Well, I don't think there's anyone in the Eastern Conference that is going to derail LeBron. And once again, we seem to be a year ahead of schedule in terms of scheduling our NBA Finals. The Lakers will be the prohibitive favorite in the West. The Heat will be the prohibitive favorite in the East. They seem to be on a collision course. And even though Laker fans will tell you they're still the team to beat, I don't think the fact that the Heat are going to have eight minimum salaried players surrounding Bosch, James, Wade, and Chalmers is going to hamstring them in their pursuit of a title. I think the Heat win the title, and I think they do so relatively easily, and I think my reaction to that will be a big who cares.
A lot of the other top free agents have returned to the teams they'd played for over their entire careers. Are you surprised by this? This has been somewhat in the shadow, of course, of the circus LeBron.
No, I like that kind of continuity. I like having loyalty to a city that nurtured you or made you, helped make you into the player you are. I like knowing what teams. Part of the reason the World Cup is so great is because we know who's going to play for which team. You know, David Villa doesn't get to call up Kaká and Cristiano Ronaldo and say, hey, guys, let's all play for Honduras this year. Like, the idea of the collusion among the players to monopolize the talent, it just ruins the competitive balance and makes the sport boring, quite frankly.
Many observers are now talking about the probability of a lockout after the next season. With this much NBA money flying around, can anybody really make the case that the league and the union are going to need to battle it out starting a year from now?
Well, it seems like management and labor can always figure out a way to make that case, you know. But with the salary cap going up and with the amount of money being thrown at these free agents, it seems like the owners are going to have a hard time making the case that they're poor. I obviously hope a lockout doesn't happen, but given what LeBron James, Dwyane Wade, and Chris Bosh have just done to the competitive balance in the NBA, if a lockout does happen, I invite all of your listeners to start following soccer.
Kevin Hench writes for FoxSports.com, and he's one half of the Spider and the Henchman podcast. Kevin, as always, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me. Cleveland, even now I can remember. Cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A couple of days a week, Anna Mallett stands in the road with one of those lollipop-shaped signs used to stop traffic so children can cross the street. That's why some in South Walsham, UK, call her the Lollipop Lady. But they smile when they say it, because Anna Mallett, all 5'4" of her, is also the only 77-year-old to have earned a 7th Dan Black Belt in Spirit Combat International Jiu-Jitsu, a martial arts skill she also teaches. Ms. Mallett, who has been credited with tackling a 14-year-old lad engaged in shoplifting, said recently, "I may be getting on a bit, but I can still deal with any big bloke who comes along." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, how young is too young when it comes to recruiting football players? But first, Major League Baseball's annual All-Star Game will transpire on Tuesday, meaning that we've reached the midpoint of the summer game season. Time to check in with our baseball guy, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
The Major League All-Star Game will take place Tuesday in Anaheim. The rosters for both leagues are now set, and there has been grumbling over some omissions, but the Reds' Joey Votto and the Yankees' Nick Swisher are in thanks to a Thursday night fan vote. Has justice been served this time around?
Well, it certainly has in Joey Votto's case. I mean, you could make a very strong case that he's the most valuable player in the National League this year. And for him to not make the All-Star team until the second time around just still doesn't make any sense. But better late than never, I guess. I would have voted Kevin Youkilis on as the alternative guy instead of Nick Swisher. Not to say Nick Swisher hasn't had an All-Star year. I just think Youkilis has been more important to his team than Swisher has been to his team. There are still some other things out there that confuse me. The Padres initially did not have a pitcher on the All-Star team, which is amazing since they lead the major leagues in ERA and other important pitching categories. They finally got Heath Bell on, but I still am not sure why Matt Latos, who's one of these really good young pitchers that not everyone's heard of, isn't on the team. But overall, I thought the fans did a terrific job with the starting lineups, and I think we should keep the fans voting. The more things they're involved in, the better.
Okay, so keep the fans voting, but are you a fan of the system which determines the World Series home team via who wins the All-Star game?
Absolutely not a fan, Bill. I don't get it. This will be my 30th All-Star game coming up this year, and I can promise you the players, now at least, are not going to the All-Star game saying, we're here to win this game first and foremost. They are there to have some fun, show off their talents, play an exhibition game, and that's how they all look at it. This is not the mid-70s, the early 80s, when Mike Schmidt and Pete Rose would say, look, they would look at the rest of the National League team and say, we're going to win this thing. Do you guys understand? That's why we're here. It doesn't work that way anymore. We really don't have National League and American League pride like we used to. We don't have NL umpires and AL umpires. We don't have league presidents. And because of free agency, we have very few guys who played only in one league. Mm-hmm. Everyone's switching back and forth. And with interleague play, it's not that big of a deal who wins the All-Star game, and therefore it should not count for home field advantage. That's way too big a situation.
Okay, back to the regular season. You have been known to say the Yankees are still the Yankees from time to time, Tim. At this point, said Yankees are in first place in the American League East, and I assume this is no surprise to you.
No, it isn't, Bill. I picked them to go to the World Series at the beginning of the year. I think they're still the team to beat in the major leagues right now for a variety of reasons. Number one, they've overcome all sorts of injuries already, including a month without Jorge Posada, a month without Curtis Granderson. The one part of their club that was supposed to be a weak part is their outfield, and yet they have two outfielders, Nick Swisher and Brett Gardner, who are all-star players, at least have had all-star numbers this year. And their starting pitching is just sensational. They found another terrific starter in Phil Hughes, who's been terrific at such a young age. So I think you put everything together, and you still have the best closer in baseball to get the final three outs. And that makes the Yankees at least as good as they were last year when they won the World Series.
The West would seem to offer the best chance for a division championship race in the National League. Only the Diamondbacks appear to be out of contention. Who wins there?
Well, I picked the Dodgers at the beginning, and I'm going to stick with the Dodgers. However, the Padres are really good, Bill, and it's amazing when you look at their lineup certain days, you wonder, how do they win? I mean, we know their pitching is great, but it's a no-name staff, especially in the bullpen, and yet they have the best bullpen in the major leagues. But I just think that the Dodgers have the best lineup, 1-8. They have a really good bullpen when everyone's healthy, and I think they'll find enough starting pitching down the stretch to win that division. But can the Padres win? Absolutely. Can the Giants? Yes. Can the Rockies? Yes. Another really good race in the major league. Four teams right down to the end. I don't see any team good enough to run away, and I think all are good enough to hang in there.
Tim, it seems to me that most of the really dramatic stories over the past couple of months in baseball have involved pitching performances. Four no-hitters, two perfect games, 19 starters with ERAs under 3. Are we just in one of those years of the pitcher?
Yes, we are, and I think this is going to continue. I think this is a trend that started a few years ago, basically in the post-steroid era. I saw Troy Gloss of the Braves the other day. He's a good hitter, and he looked at me, just volunteered. He said, does everyone in the major leagues throw 95 miles an hour? Do they all do? Because he said, we just got done with the Tigers, and everyone on that staff throws 95. I talked to Tony Gwynn the other day, and he told me, as he counsels his son, Tony Gwynn Jr., he tells him, look, this is not the game that I played. He said, when I played, we had a few guys who threw 92. That's it. He said, now everyone throws a lot harder than that. And to me, that's the real sign that velocity is king again. It is back, and we've got pitching all over the place. And I don't think this is a one-year thing. I think this is going to keep up. We'll never get to 1968, and no one suggests we will. But we've gotten a long, long way away from the steroid era where runs scored were just out of control. Now it's going clearly the other direction.
All right. It's prediction time. You've had half a season's worth of data to evaluate. Who plays whom in the 2010 World Series and who wins?
Well, I'm going to say the Yankees make it to the World Series again. And instead of saying that they're going to play the Phillies in the World Series, as I said at the beginning of the year, I think they're going to play the Braves in the World Series this time. Atlanta has really done a good job with its pitching. They've scored a few more runs than I thought they could. They've got Bobby Cox, their Hall of Fame manager, in his final year, and possibly Chipper Jones, their Hall of Fame third baseman, in his final year. I think all signs point towards a Braves-Yankees World Series, and I can't wait till October, because then I have a chance to be wrong twice with my original prediction and then my mid-season prediction.
Jim Kirchen covers baseball modestly for ESPN, and he joins me to talk about the game from time to time as well. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Bill.
Summer, of course, is a time for enjoying baseball, cycling, and a host of warm weather activities. Summer is also a time when many football players practice their skills on sizzling gridirons. Some do so at combines all around the country where participants are drilled, weighed, measured, and otherwise evaluated. Combines are a big deal for serious young athletes, even down to the middle school level. They're also a big business for those who run them. But the NCAA is now considering legislation that could diminish their impact. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff reports.
When a quarterback from Delaware named David Sills made a verbal commitment in February to play college football at USC, it was big news. Why? Because Sills was just a seventh grader. Fast forward a few months to a cramped and dim weight room in North Carolina's Robert Patton High School. It's full of kids who'd give anything to be in Sills' shoes. Coaches want to see how many times these players can bench press 135 pounds. It's one of several drills these kids compete in over 4 hours to show off their speed, strength, agility, and overall football skills. A group cheers freshman Carson Elmore as he lifts. Carson is here because he wants to play college football.
You need to show out as much as you can to the coaches so you get noticed more than one time just coming to the games. They can't always see everything there. So I think coming to the combine is a really important thing to do.
It used to be that combines were only for college players trying to impress NFL scouts. They became mainstream for high school juniors and seniors in the early 2000s. And now it's an industry that also caters to middle schoolers who want to get on the radar of college recruiters. A New Jersey-based company called National Underclassmen has 51 combines this year for some 17,000 football players. It usually costs around $85 to attend. Some have estimated the combine industry generates around $100 million a year. Vinny Pacelli was in charge of the National Underclassmen event we attended. It is a business, yes, he says, but it's one that gives kids a chance to succeed.
And any one of the coaches, especially out here today, well, the fact is they were all in those shoes. They were all at that level, and, you know, they want to make sure that no stone is left unturned, and every kid has the opportunity to come out there and compete.
Pacelli says the addition of middle school students to the combine circuit just reflects the current college recruiting environment.
The recruiting process starts at such a young age that the guys that wait until their junior year, it's almost too late. It's gotten to the point where the kids are starting to understand it, that they need to get out and build a resume and build a profile at a younger age.
Many parents say they bring their young athletes out of fear they'll get left behind. Some have even flown their sons cross-country to attend certain combines. Gary Lease's son, Trevor, attended two combines last year. Gary says it's all part of preparing a serious athlete for college.
The scores that you get for 40 in shuttle and broad are almost as important as SAT scores, so you want to make sure those things continue to progress.
These combines and the early recruitment of young athletes have caught the attention of the NCAA. Patrina Long is an associate athletic director at UCLA. She says there's something wrong when coaches make verbal offers to an athlete before anyone knows what kind of student they'll turn out to be.
You simply don't have enough academic information, and when you add the athletic component, you certainly don't know how that student's going to grow and mature over time to see if they're really going to be compatible with the quality of your program.
Long chairs the NCAA's recruiting cabinet, which is in the process of reviewing the overall recruiting model. Long says she's heard from parents and administrators who think changes are in order. She's also heard from coaches who say they've recruited athletes who are too young because they don't want to lose out to other schools doing the same thing. Long's cabinet recently proposed banning verbal offers to athletes until after their junior year. Colleges would also have to have on file the student's academic records up to that point. Stuart Mandel, a college football writer for SportsIllustrated.com, says the NCAA needed to do something.
Because it's certainly something that every time it happens, the reaction is universally negative. So it is important that they probably take a stance and address that.
But Mandel isn't convinced the legislation will have the effect the NCAA is looking for.
You're trying to regulate something that there's no record of, verbal commitments or verbal offers to players. So on the one hand, I understand their motivation, trying to ease the pressure on kids who get recruited from a very early age. On the other hand, I mean, you can't be naive, and you have to realize that regulations are not. Coaches are going to have contact with players, whether it's on official visits, whether it's scouting their high school games. And if they can't make an offer to a kid, that doesn't mean they can't tell them how strongly interested they are.
Mandel says even if NCAA members approve the proposed recruiting changes early next year, he doesn't think they'd have much of an effect on middle school combines. That industry, he thinks, is here to stay. Long, though, thinks their significance may be diminished if there are new rules for coaches to play by.
So if we don't allow them to make early offers, don't allow them to recruit at things like that, then there's obviously a fairly direct correlation about how important that particular thing is. Doesn't mean it's not still useful, but it changes things dramatically if all the coaches don't have to be there.
But in the meantime, young athletes continue to do everything they can to get coaches' attention.
You got to be here. You got to be kick slide, right there. Right.
Remember Carson Elmore? He was at the combine we visited. Carson ended up benching 135 pounds 23 times. His vertical jump was 26.5 inches, broad jump 8 feet. He ran the 40-yard dash in 5.13 seconds. His shuttle time, 4.73 seconds. Those numbers might not mean much to you, but for Carson, they're huge. He was one of 32 players among 83 at this combine to be invited to a national underclassmen regional camp last month in Atlanta. Still, here's a number Carson must improve upon. At 5'10", he weighs only 157 pounds. But remember, he'll only be a sophomore. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
You're listening to Only a Game. Malvina Abbott, who hears Only a Game on KPBS in San Diego, emailed recently to say, "I love the show, especially the book reviews / interviews." Regarding one such book review / interview, my conversation with Dan Epstein about his book about baseball in the 70s, Big Hair and Plastic Grass, a listener named Jim had some issues. He began his email by saying, "Good story," but went on to say, "I'm disappointed that you didn't talk more about my beautiful Pittsburgh Pirates, who won the World Series in 71 and 79. 71 featured the final recognition of Roberto Clemente as a major star. We Bucco fans spend lots of time thinking about those teams, since they have barely been competitive since." Christopher Thomas is among the listeners who emailed with World Cup-related comments, but Mr. Thomas is the only one who composed haiku about the event. One of them celebrated the Japanese team thusly: "Your crazy game shows pale in excitement next to your soccer prowess." In connection with other matters poetic, Donald Becker expressed his appreciation of my conversation 2 weeks ago with the official Wimbledon Championships poet. "I liked the interview," he wrote, "and I know this was not the point you intended to make, but this guy clearly met his match in you. In a poetry contest, you could beat him 70-68 in the fifth set." Perhaps, but would anybody be left in the stadium to witness my triumph? Move to comment by another tennis story, this one having to do with promising youngsters in Florida. Ray Cruitt emailed as follows: "High marks go to Ron Schachter for his story on tornado and hurricane." A couple of weeks ago, I shared an email from a listener who wondered if others felt as she did, that today's brand of basketball is less interesting than the game used to be. I invited comments on that observation, and Tom Brannon, who hears the program on KUHF in Houston, responded, "I believe this goes for virtually all sports," he wrote. "The capabilities of the players far exceed the original physical parameters of the games. The players are too good for the size of the field or the size of the goal or something. It's like sending the high school team out to play on the elementary school playground." We'll happily air your views on this matter or any other. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Or you can contact us through our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio, and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. Extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
A dog may be man's best friend, but at least one dachshund currently living in Russia may doubt that the relationship is reciprocal. The dachshund's name is Boniface, and his owner, one Sergei Gobrinov, a professional diver in Vladivostok, has fitted Boniface with a diving suit complete with a helmet and taken the pooch scuba diving. During a recent demonstration of the unlikely skill, Boniface was reported to be barking eagerly, though that may have been a guess on the part of the reporter. Mr. Gobrinov has said that he doesn't think the dog experiences any stress underwater, but according to witnesses, when diving with this weird-looking plastic thing attached to his pointy little head, Boniface has been known to emit high-pitched whines, which is what I do when I experience stress. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the bike snob steps out from behind his mask and wheels away. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and I'm staying right here where I began my career until
excellent.
We win a championship or something.
You anticipate my first question. I don't know how you did it.
I suspect I anticipate your first five questions.
Well, the LeBron James Hour was a big hit on Thursday night. Balloons, dancers, fireworks, kazoo playing, things of that
and
nature.
And an extraordinarily apathetic audience in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Well, so you were watching.
Of course.
Okay.
How could you not?
As the entire universe knows, by now LeBron chose Miami to play alongside Heat veteran Dwayne Wade and the newly acquired Chris Bosh. Did LeBron get the guaranteed championship-winning team that he was after?
Well, we're going to have to see, and I know that's a boring answer, but it's the truth. A couple of things about this. Number one, I would not want to be Chris Bosh, because if they don't win, it's going to land on him. It's not going to land on the other two guys. Number two, I would not want to be Miami Heat Eric Spoelstra, because if you think Pat Riley can keep his mitts off this much talent, I wouldn't want to be there for the first two-game losing streak. Can they win a championship? Sure, but they've got holes to fill. They have virtually nobody else on the contract. They gave Michael Beasley, who was the number one draft pick a while back, away to Minnesota for a bag full of doorknobs. Luckily, that's all Minnesota traffic's in these days, so they were able to make the deal. Yeah, so there's still more work to do there.
Cavaliers owner Dan Gilbert issued an open letter to LeBron after his decision on Thursday night, and the Cleveland Plain Dealer expressed their disappointment with a full-page, front-page graphic. I guess it's fair to say there's a little bit of bitterness in Cleveland.
I'll tell you what. The Cleveland Cavaliers were once owned by Ted Stepien, universally regarded as the worst owner in the history of sports, not named Marty Schott. Okay? The idea they could find somebody almost as nutty boggles the actuarial table. He was there for 7 years, folks. I think getting over it is recommended.
Well, the beauty of this letter is that the current Cleveland Cavaliers owner guarantees that the Cavaliers will win an NBA championship before LeBron James' team does.
Well, we'll see. I'm willing to bet all of the money in my pocket against all of the money in Dan Gilbert's pocket that that's not the case.
Meanwhile, LeBron is involved in a paternity suit, Charlie, and it's a suit in which he is alleged to be not the father, but the child. Help me out with this.
Well, I think the phrase opportunism comes immediately to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Someone named Lester Bryce Stovall said he's the victim of a DNA cover-up by Gloria James, who he claims he met in a Washington, D.C. bar in 1984. At the time, she was 15 and he was 29. He's got bigger problems, if this is right. This guy's a graduate of Princeton University and a University of Chicago law school, and he's a senior legal advisor for the Security and Exchange Commission. Yee!
It's curiouser and
curiouser. Absolutely.
Even before LeBron James decided which team's fans he would delight, the NBA announced that next season's salary cap would be $58.04 million. This means what? That the league has been more profitable than previously thought?
Yeah, that the league has been poor-mouthing in the run-up to the great free agent summer of 2010. We'll go back to poor-mouthing around January of next year when the labor Armageddon stops. But it does mean that Miami's going to have a little bit of an easier time filling in the gaps around their three stars.
Charlie, I can't believe it's taken us this long to get to the real free agent news of the week. The NHL free agency period is also in full swing. Have you been roped in by speculation over the fate of superstar free agent Ilya Kovalchuk?
Well, I suspect we're going to have an hour-long special on the Ilya Kovalchuk decision on the Versus Network, formerly the Really Big Fish Network.
It's not going to be
on ESPN.
And
I suspect I'll be missing it.
There would have been partying in Spain this week, even if on Wednesday their national team hadn't earned a spot in the finals of the World Cup, because July 7th is a big party day in Pamplona. Just ask anybody who's ever read Hemingway. But this time around, the party was bigger than ever. I wonder what they're going to do to top it if Spain wins tomorrow.
Well, you've got two teams playing, in my limited understanding of World Cup soccer, who really have been waiting a long time for this. So I suspect that either the fleshpots of Las Ramblas in Barcelona or the hash bars of Amsterdam are really going to be jumping come Monday morning.
We spoke last week about an octopus in Germany making World Cup predictions. The eight-legged prognosticator picked Spain against Germany. Of course, Spain won that one. What's his reward for accuracy likely to be?
The Germans want him cut up and grilled for their delectation, probably as an hors d'oeuvre while they watch the championship, for being right.
Yeah.
Exactly, and just hoping that, you know, the fans in Cleveland don't get this news over their wire services or their intertubes, because who knows what they're... So far, they've only been barbecuing jerseys.
For the record, the octopus has picked Spain, so Holland,
I think he may
beware.
Be wrong. Hmm. My pick, Bill, is the plucky Dutch.
Ah.
I think they're going to win. Do you want to know why?
Yes.
Because they're very solid and very balanced, and Spain, to be honest with you, didn't show me a lot against Germany.
They didn't?
No.
They possessed the ball for 76% of the time.
They did, but they didn't do anything with it, you
see. They kept the other team from doing anything.
Well, they're not going to be able to do that against the Dutch, because the Dutch will not sit back that way, and the Dutch will not be missing their best scorer as the Germans were. He's gobsmacked. He's dumbfounded, ladies and gentlemen.
Yo no sé. Peru. Peru didn't even make it to the World Cup. How have they managed to get along in the festival anyway?
They've been smuggling dope in the Vuvuzela, which, as we know, is a large plastic horn and not a bodily orifice.
It's just a dopey thing to do.
But I wonder what if what was tipped off is that people were lighting small fires within the barrel of the Vuvuzela and trying to play it while inhaling.
Well, I would much more appreciate that sound than the sound of actual vuvuzelas, of which I have grown tired.
Yeah, but when 9,000 people playing vuvuzelas all of a sudden start playing trucking, that should be a tip-off.
11 months after she was suspended from competition following allegations regarding her gender, Caster Semenya has been cleared to return to the track by the International Association of Athletics Federations. Her lawyer said, quote, "Hopefully this resolution will set a precedent so that no female athlete in the future will have to experience long delays and public scrutiny." Is that likely to be the case?
No, because this will happen again probably not very soon, but it will happen to someone again. I'm glad she's been cleared. I'm glad she's going to get a chance to race. It's interesting, though, that all we've talked about, she's still competing in junior competitions. She's only 19 years old.
I'm sorry. I'm still thinking of all those vuvuzelas playing trucking. And finally, Charlie, in setting a world record for solving two Rubik's Cubes simultaneously, David Calvo said, "I found I was very focused on getting it done as quickly as possible." Explain his focus.
Well, he was underwater in a shark tank while he was solving the Rubik's Cube. Now, he solved them underwater before, but I guess he needed more of a challenge. The biggest thing, I'm very happy about is the sharks did not solve what they like to call the wetsuit problem. Charlie. The how does the aqualung taste puzzle.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time in the Shark Tank. In the studio. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You got to mellow slow. It takes time to pick a place to go. And just keep trucking on home. Sitting and staring out of the hotel window. Got a tip, they're gonna kick the door in.
Everybody knows who Lance Armstrong is. He's won the Tour de France 7 times. Even as I speak, he's trying to make it 8. But until quite recently, the identity of the bike snob was a mystery. Unless you are seriously involved in cycling, this may seem a matter of little concern, but cyclists constantly in touch with the blog Bike Snob had been wondering for years who was posting all those rants against careless motorists and celebrations of the glorious possibilities of two-wheeling through life. With the publication of Bike Snob, subtitled Systematically and Mercilessly Realigning the World of Cycling, Bike Snob NYC, a.k.a. Eben Weiss, has come out of the garage, as it were, and he joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here. For the record, I don't have a garage. This is New York. Our space is limited here.
We probably keep it in the kitchen.
If necessary,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
In a chapter titled, I Want In, Now What?, you contend that, quote, like vampirism, there is an initiation process when you become a cyclist. Was this an attempt to capitalize on the current popularity of vampires on TV, in the movies, elsewhere in the culture?
No, not even remotely. I'm not even into the vampire thing. I always thought that was really nerdy. Like, cycling's nerdy, and I'm a nerd and a dork and all of it. But the vampire thing is nerdy times a million, like people who are way into vampire things. So no, but there is a parallel in that it is a group of people that has its own sort of rules and ways of recognizing each other and modes of discourse and all of that.
You present a lot of different categories of cyclists, almost as if you were trotting out intriguing specimens for people coming to the zoo. Tell us about the beautiful Godzilla.
The beautiful Godzilla is a type of cyclist that I regularly encounter here in New York. And depending on where you live, you may or may not encounter a similar creature. Usually a young woman, usually attractive, expensively attired on a vintage bicycle. And because of the pleasing package, they can sort of get away with things on their bicycles that the rest of humanity cannot, like riding on the sidewalk, riding right at you, riding against traffic. You know, me, I ride the cars. They want to nail me. But if the beautiful Godzilla rides across the street, traffic stops, you know, they get away with murder. And, that I did steal. Well, I acknowledge that comes from Seinfeld. You know, he dated a beautiful Godzilla, but she didn't ride a bike.
Have you another favorite specimen of cyclist you wish to discuss?
There are so many of them. Right now, we're in the midst of the Tour de France, or France, as it's properly said.
And that's the French so foppishly call it.
Yeah, they're so pretentious. And so obviously this is a big moment for one particular type of cyclist, which is the roadie. So the Tour de France cyclist would be sort of, you know, the platonic ideal of the roadie. And obviously that trickles down to the guy you might see on the bike path or something with a bike that's way too expensive, who's like got his head down and is hammering like it's the Champs-Élysées, you know, yelling at the little kids to get out of my way. Poor kid's just learning how to ride a bicycle. He looks up. There's some guy who's 50 pounds heavier than the heaviest Tour de France cyclist bearing down on him on a carbon fiber bicycle. So there's that. This is roadie season.
Well, regarding your own activism of a sort on behalf of cyclists, you say you are, quote, like a Voltron of cycling dorkitude. I am going to have to ask for a translation.
Where should I start? Voltron? Does that need explanation?
Please.
Voltron was, it was like a cartoon robot, or at least when I was a kid he was, who would sort of, many little robots would come together to form the big Voltron robot.
Uh-huh.
Likewise, I myself, you know, talking about the different types of cyclists I refer to or make fun of in the book, most of those types of cyclists I am at one time or another. I race my bike. I'm a roadie sometimes. I'm an urban cyclist sometimes. I ride a cyclocross guy. I'm many of them. So that's what I meant by that I'm all of these in one. And I think I mentioned that in the context of rides like Critical Mass, where people want to sort of swamp the streets and show that they're out there. I think it's sort of better to show that you're out there by just riding your bike, just doing it. And I feel like by riding in all these different ways, I'm putting myself out there in a more constructive, I hate to say constructive, but a more constructive way than Critical Mass.
You begin each chapter in your book with a few words from a well-known person, unless all those quotes are nonsense. For example, I guess I can believe that John F. Kennedy might have once said, "Nothing compares to the simple pleasure of a bike ride."
Yeah.
But did Noam Chomsky ever say bikes have wheels?
Not to my knowledge,
uh-huh.
No.
Uh-huh. No. So you made that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And likewise, Charles Manson saying, "I'm out of the saddle, sprinting up that hill and eating glazed donut bracelets off the right arm of Jesus."
That also, not to my knowledge, although I would not be surprised if he said that because it sounds like something he would say.
I'm not sure that really qualifies as a reason to put somebody's name on something.
What's the thing with the million monkeys and the typewriter and one of them's going to type Shakespeare? Like, Manson's just rattling off that stuff all the time. So what do you have, 40 years of insane ramblings or however many years it's been? I'm sure those words and that combination did come out of his mouth at some time. And I'm going to stand by that.
It seems obvious that cycling can improve one's health in lots of ways. Exercise is good. Nobody would argue with that. But don't you think you went a little bit over the top when you wrote you were probably a brain-dead, zombie-like, sleeping and eating machine before you became a cyclist?
I mean, obviously that's hyperbole, and I express myself in hyperbole to make a point a lot. But I do think that leading a physical lifestyle can really, I mean, it makes you leaner physically and it makes you leaner mentally. And I feel almost pretentious saying it. Yet at the same time, riding a bike is something that has taught me a lot. It's influenced the way I think. It kind of streamlines your thought process. And going back to cars, you know, so many people drive unaware or distracted, and people do that on bikes too, as I said, but at the same time, a bicycle doesn't allow you to do that the way a car does. I mean, cars, especially the way they are now, they're like your living room. You're sitting on what amounts to a sofa. You're completely detached from the road, from the environment. You know, you have climate control and all sorts of creature comforts. You're almost passive in a car. A bicycle, there are plenty of bicyclists who are not as aware as they should be, but at the same time, it's impossible to be totally divorced from what's going on around you on a bicycle. You know what's going on the road because you're a few feet from it. There's nothing between you and it. You're engaged. And to a larger extent, cycling in general, it makes you engaged mentally and physically.
Eben, back in the anonymous blogging days, did motorists ever respond to you with hate mail?
No. In fact, I got surprisingly little, if any, hate mail, which I thought when I started my blog I would get mostly hate mail. In fact, I thought I'd get drummed off the internet, but that wasn't the case. And, well, first of all, anyone coming to my blog is probably interested in cycling. But beyond that, I like to think that people understand what I'm saying, which is I'm not indicting motorists or the car. I'm indicting stupidity. And and that's the difference. I can't stress enough that I'm not some anti-car person at all. I use cars. There's a tendency to want to pit cars versus cyclists and blame each other and point fingers at each other. And I think all of that is laughable.
Evan Weiss, a.k.a. Bike Snob NYC, is the author of Bike Snob, Systematically and Mercilessly Realigning the World of Cycling. It's published by Chronicle Books, and he joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Evan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and first-time daddy Doug Trabu. Congratulations from all of us. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Michael Garth and from old friend Pam Grimaud. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Dutch supporter Johan Hanskamp, who reacts to my assertion that I shall be rooting for Spain in tomorrow's World Cup final.
I don't like you, Bill.
Ah, well, I like you, Dutch prophet, even in that silly hat. Go Spain. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.